The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi everyone, and this should be such a great episode today because my guest has worked with some of the top golfers in the world. He was also the first official psychologist for a winning Ryder Cup team, and he's worked with three different Premier League clubs. Now, all of these sports are so fascinating to me, having a background in football and absolutely loving golf. So I'm really going to be interested in picking his brains, and because he has the inside track on what it's like to understand the mindset of an elite athlete. I hope you're looking forward to this as much as I am. So let's get into this. Hi, everyone, and welcome back or welcome to the Psychology of Success. I'm Paul McVeigh, and as a Premier League footballer, I was always fascinated by the world of psychology and mental performance. And as I introduce today's guest, he's been a performance psychologist for the first ever Ryder Cup team. He also went on and was the psychologist for six top golfers, as well as three Premier League teams. So I'm absolutely delighted to introduce Jamil Qureshi to today's show. Jamil, how are you doing, my friend?
Hello, Paul. I'm very good. How are you?
Brilliant. No, I'm great. Listen, thank you very much for joining us. And of course, I really want to pick your brains on all of the things I've just mentioned in terms of the incredible career you've had and having touched on any of the keynote speaking and the work you do in the corporate world. But the way I want to introduce or get off up and running today is the first question that I ask every guest that comes on the Psychology of Success. And that is, what is the definition of success?
Oh, okay. I always say it's the ability to make the connection between two things previously unconnected. That's my definition of success. Make the connection between two things previously unconnected. Success for me usually is about, you know, people who choose to use their talent in a way that they hadn't used previously. Or invest in their talent in a way that they hadn't before. Or in business, you'll often find it's sort of two people who come together, argue, debate, share, and create ideas which are bigger and better than what they could create on their own. So the same with ideas, actually. I always believe that ideas are networks. You know, one and one does make one, like two drops of water, put them together to get another drop of water. It's the same with ideas. Put two ideas together, tend to get one bigger than the two on their own. So success for me is all about connectivity, and probably the way in which we're living now, I've probably seen that more than we ever have done. I found that, you know, the more connected we can become, you know, either with our colleagues or with our own feelings and our own talents, start to understand them better, you know, maybe the more we can drive success.
Brilliant. I knew you were going to have a fascinating answer, because interestingly, in the first couple of shows, I've had people who have had a rugby background or ran at the Olympics or played in the NFL. And their version of success generally was to do with their sport and career. But I kind of had a feeling you were going to give me a completely different definition and understanding.
Well, the thing for me is that, you know, I've never really achieved anything. I've only worked with people who have. So, you know, when you speak to all your professional football players and rugby players, you know, they're probably taught from their own context, where, you know, for me as a psychologist and performance coach, that I'm only ever in the shadows of the glory of all the people I work with.
but listen, that is also a huge skill in itself, because I think what's really fascinating is, you know, so many people talk about the link with sport and business, and essentially what they're talking about is how to take the lessons of why people, like you just said, these guys who have played in the NFL or ran in the Olympics, you know, how have they done that? Why do they do it? And then how can that be transposed across to the corporate world? And you look like you're the perfect person to take someone who's worked in sport and bring that into the business world.
Yes. Well, I think that, you know, all our hopes, fears, desires, ambitions are the same. So whether you're a CEO or whether you're a golfer, you know, we all want to be better. We've all got sort of dreams we want to realise. But we also got the same fears and same insecurities. So I see some real parallels in it. And I think there's lessons which are transferable. Lots of lessons from business that sports people can learn. Lots of lessons from sport that business people can learn. And I think there's some real common principles between them. I would say, to pull out a couple. Purpose. You know, one thing I've noticed is that the most successful business people and sports people are incredibly purposeful. So in business, I always say that purpose maximization will always drive profit maximization. In sport, you know, purpose is something which, you know, allows us to outperform objectives and targets. So I think the mistake that people make with purpose, I sometimes sort of see it, you know, more in the business world than the sports world, is that purpose is never achieved. It's attained on a daily basis. And this is why so many sports people, you know, perform so well, is that purpose is never achieved. It's attained on a daily basis. It's a reason. It's about a morning, you know, wanting to be fulfilled, expressing themselves in their particular sport.
I think we just had a little bit of a struggle with the audio there, but I understand that everything you're talking about is essentially around purpose and then why people are going to get up in the morning and why they do that. So just because I know you've worked very comprehensively across sport and business, so what came first for you?
Yeah, well, for me, I fell into sport. I had an interest in psychology. I decided to chase my passion rather than my pension. I love psychology, so I thought I'd do something with it. And it was sports people who found me more than anything else. So I ended up working in golf by default. I don't know golf and didn't like it. I just ended up working with some very good players straight away. And part of my advantage, actually, was the fact that I didn't know anything about it. So I couldn't talk technique or anything to them. I could only talk about the things that, you know, genuinely mattered in the end, you know, which was their approach to, you know, their career, their approach to their life and, you know, what golf meant to it. So it was a real disadvantage to think like an outsider. And I went into many sports initially that I knew had a very little knowledge of, and I see it as a real advantage now. And the same with, you know, business. I always say that, you know, the immigrant will always see things that the citizen is blind to. You know, it's almost easier to come up with probing questions when you're childlike, when you don't have the knowledge. So it was a real advantage that, you know, I worked in sports that, you know, I genuinely didn't care for. And so, you know, had some real success with it, which led on to other sports. And then I guess the corporate audiences sort of found me, as you well know, Paul, that business is intrinsically linked with sport at a high level. So I had people in, I don't know, BMW would say to me that, you know, you're working with some of the golf players who are really good. Can you come and talk to my sales team, please? And for some reason, I ended up sort of making that transition, ended up sort of doing lots of talks to the corporate world, went back into that sort of space, really. So 5% of what I do now is with sports people, 95% is really with sort of business audiences.
And I think that's such a great insight into maybe someone who's starting off, you know, because you're kind of saying that, you know, you didn't really have any love for it or you didn't really have any knowledge of that particular sport, but maybe people who are either just studying it or qualified and want to get into it, hopefully that'll give them a little bit of encouragement just to keep going, because, you know, you never know where that could go. But can you give us some examples of maybe some of the golfers you've worked with and maybe some of the things that maybe little kind of light bulb moments for them of how they suddenly maybe turned a corner in terms of a psychological point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, a couple of things. I mean, I've worked with you know, lots, really. So I've worked with lots of golfers. You know, Darren Clark, Paul McGinley, Garcia, Carlson, Monty, and Westwood. I tell you, loads of them. And I always think that, you know, for my role as a coach is really to help change perspectives. So when you change a perspective in someone, you don't give them new talent. You allow them to use the talent that they've already got in a different way to which they're currently using it. So it's really about allowing people to see things differently, to allow them to do things differently. So if you want someone to act differently, the best way to get them to commit sustainably to acting differently is to get them to think differently. So I used to always work on changing the words and pictures in people's heads and to change the way in which they feel about something and then the way in which they act. So some players, without breaching confidences, will need to be more motivated. Some people need to be less motivated. Some people need to commit better to targets and goals. Some people need to be more freewheeling. Some people need to relax more. I don't know, put the pressure on. So I'd always work with the individual in relation to what they need. In regard to changing perspectives, I'll give you a good example. You know, there was one golfer who I worked with who was particularly up when he won. Very happy when he won, very down when he lost. Played badly, it was dreadful, absolutely awful. And so he really struggled with a perspective. And so his moods were big ups and big downs, you know. And I've always said it, you know, I know, Paul, that, you know, you were a high performer in the Premiership. And, you know, I saw it in Premiership football teams. I could go into a Premiership football club on a Sunday morning. If I didn't know the result, I could tell whether they won or lost. I said, you just tell them that Sunday morning. And I think that this golfer really suffered from this. Now, consistency of mind gives you consistency of play. The more consistent you are in your thinking, the more consistent you are in your performance. So this chap was up and down. And I said to him, where do you want to be in 5 years' time? And he said, I want to be top five in the world. He was 17th at the time. So I said, okay, then, if you lost this week and played dreadfully, played awful, could you be top five in 5 years' time? He said, yes, I can be. I said, okay, then. I said, if you played great and you won this week, could you be top five in 5 years' time? He said, yes, I can be. So in a way, it almost proves that both results, both outcomes are inconsequential. But it doesn't really matter. You still achieve the end goal. I said, if you learned nothing this week, then could you be top five in 5 years' time? Particularly if you continue to learn nothing for the next 5 years. He said, no. I said, okay, then. So immediately this emphasis had gone from winning and losing into this space of learning. And you know, and again, you'll see it from professional sports. Sometimes you can win a game and you'll learn nothing. Sometimes you'll lose a game and you'll learn lots. So what's most valuable to you in relation to your long-term goal? And I think that keeping a perspective on things for players who are in the heat of battle in the moment is incredibly important as a psychologist and performance coach.
And you know what, Jamil, that's really interesting, because I have gone through those exact same times when, you know, I would play well and would win and I'd be delighted for the weekend. And of course, other times, more likely than not, that I had a bad game or didn't get picked or didn't play. And I ended up just, you know, really beating myself up and being pretty down. And it was actually only whenever I worked with a sports psychologist, a guy called Gavin Drake, and he shared the very simple things that you've taught. Well, I say simple. They were profound for me at the time, of how if my outcome isn't what I want, then it's really how I think about that outcome that's going to make the biggest difference. But because I wasn't aware of that before, this was a complete game changer for me.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's really important for players, you know, and again, let's look at that business audience too. It's really important for us to know that we can fail. It doesn't make you a failure. You make mistakes, it doesn't make you a mistake. And we need to detach the action from the person to allow us the best learning opportunity and best perspective. You know, players get injured, players get dropped, they're not picked, you know, they don't train so well, but, you know, they miss an easy opportunity. You know, these things happen to, you know, some of the best players in the world. I often say that, you know, let's go back to the golf sort of analogy. I often say, when people say to me, who's going to win this golf tournament? And I say to them, I'll tell you exactly who's going to win this golf tournament. So the person who will win is not the person who makes the least mistakes. It's the person who responds best to the mistakes that they make. You know, and you know, sport is about continual adjustment. It is about winning and losing. And if we see both of those things equally, and they don't become sort of attitudes, but more outcomes, we get ourselves the best learning opportunity from them. So, you know, I think that, you know, dealing with circumstance and situation, being responsible for how we feel and what we think, I think can truly lead to some real successful outcomes. We go back to your original question. Your first question was, what's success? I was a bit mischievous at, you know, when I said that, you know, it's about connecting things that we don't usually connect. You know, I also think that some, the success is the continued accomplishment of goals, which are personal to the individual. And one of the issues that people have when they talk about success is they do it as a comparison. and we compare ourselves to our next door neighbor or someone else who's in the same defensive unit to us, or someone who's in the same midfield position, you know, or someone we went to school with, and have someone in the office. And, you know, it's not about a comparison to others. It's the continued accomplishment of goals which are personal to the individual. So in a way, going back to your last question or point, that, you know, we need to think about what we are capable of achieving and how we optimize our own potential and navigate the situation and circumstance, which is unpredictable, complex and uncertain, but make fuller and better choices towards where we want to be.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
I really would be really understand how you actually worked with that Ryder Cup team, because to go from someone who, as you just said, you didn't really like golf, didn't really know a lot about the sport, to then go into a team who is at the very, very top of their performance level and go in and work with those guys to go on and have an incredible achievement of winning. Was it by record margin ever? Was that what happened?
Yeah, record equaling, I think. But look, it's a bit of a red herring, really. These guys are super performers anyway. So I always think it's easier to take someone from fifth in the world to number one, you know, than it is to get someone from 300th in the world to 200th, you know, because the raw material is so good. You know, whenever I've worked in Premiership football clubs, I've always worked in clubs who are in the bottom three at Christmas. And it's the only time I get called in is bottom three at Christmas. I feel as though it's harder work. You know, if you were... Now, you're working with a club who is like sixth or seventh, you know, and they're trying to get to sort of top four in the Premiership. You know, it feels like that's an easier challenge. But, you know, when the wheels have come off a little bit, you know, it's harder to sort of put them back on. And I think that, you know, when the club team are working together, they're high performers anyway. The interesting thing is that the European Tour would be, who I work with, European players, would be easier to work with than the American players. When we go, won't go into the detail, but the setup of the tour is different. These guys really know each other, stay in the same hotels, got the same coaches, same psychologists. You know, I'd already worked with a few of those players as individuals. So there's already a camaraderie or team spirit. And then, although they compete against each other all year round, they come together for one week in a year and play perfectly as a team. I guess the essentials of that, you know, are the same for any good team, which is a common purpose. Let's understand what winning looks like. Secondly, let's value each other's contribution. Let's be respectful. Let's know that we're a team and can only be a set of winners if we create the winners. So it's not just about winning our individual bit, but contributing to the dynamic. You know. And then thirdly, let's be supportive of each other. Let's make sure that we understand that some things will work and some things won't. But it's up to us to maintain the dynamic and motivation and consistency of how we approach our way of working and way of doing this week.
Yeah, and as you say, you're working with top performers anyway, so there's probably at that stage, there's not a lot of stuff you actually need to give them or information. Would it be more just maybe helping them stay maybe focused or stay on track to what they're trying to achieve?
Yes. I mean, you know, it's 2006, so it's Ryder Cup in K Club. And it was Darren Clark's first venture out, you know, after, you know, the tragic news of his wife dying. And so incredibly emotional. And I mean, you know what these sporting tournaments are like, amazingly loud and huge support for both teams. So with Darren, it was never a matter of, you know, talking golf. You know, it was a matter of, you know, enabling that focus to take shape. And Darren's a high-class performer anyway. So it wasn't as though, you know, he was in a bad position and needs fixing. You know, he's in a very good position, you know, and it probably just needs, you know, a bit of a consolidation on his thinking, you know, as much as anything else. Darren played great. The team won. But, you know, my contribution with Darren was minimal. But, you know, he was doing very well. And it's almost a check-in and a chat. You know, someone who isn't going to talk about golf for half an hour in an evening. So some of my best psychology has really just been sort of sat around not saying anything, but allowing someone to say something to you. And, you know, you feel as though, and this is why, you know, and again, you made a point about some young people sort of, you know, developing a career and maybe not knowing all the answers. It's not a bad thing to not know all the answers because, you know, a bit like learning to swim by reading a book, you know, it just doesn't happen that way. You know, you learn it as you go along and you evolve into a psychologist. You know, there's very few, and you must see it all the time, there's very few Premiership footballers who turn up ready-made. You know, that they come in and you know, you almost start to learn the game as you start to play it at that level. It just so happens that some learn it very quickly.
And I think that's a really good point you make. And I just wanted to go back a couple of minutes when you talked about how the football teams that you worked with, it was whenever things have gone pretty poorly for them. They're in the bottom three. And then that's kind of when you get the call. And ironically, every time I work with a sports psychologist, or at least our team did, was when we were struggling and we weren't performing. And I think that's almost part of the issue with this whole world of psychology and mental performance, because a lot of people pick it up when things are pretty much at rock bottom, as opposed to you're already performing well and how do you get better?
Do you know, it's a really, really good point. And a lot of people don't necessarily realise it. It's funny because I can pretty much guarantee you that every golfer who came to see me, it was probably because things weren't working. But this isn't going great at the moment. Golfers come and see you when they can't hit a cow's ass with a banjo. I was swinging it left and swinging it right. Can you come and help me? There was only one golfer ever who came to see me and said, I'm playing great. I'm playing the golf of my life. And, you know, how do I maintain this? And it was actually Robert Carlson, the Swedish golfer, and, you know, who came to me and said, I'm playing great. I think, how can I continue to win? And, you know, it's a bit like seeing a physio. People go to see physios when they're injured. Now, you should go and see a physio all the time to maintain your health and fitness. So I totally agree. And I think that, you know, sometimes maybe, do you know what, maybe it's a perception thing, or used to be, that I don't want to go and see a psychologist because, you know, it appears that I'm weak. And then when you're forced into doing so because you're losing your position or losing your career, or someone says you have to go and do it, then you begrudgingly take yourself off to go and see someone. But, you know, I think things have changed. I mean, people are seeing that or understanding, you know, the difference between winning and losing is what happens behind the eyes. Sometimes with teams or with individuals, they have equal talent. But it's how they use that talent and apply that talent which makes the difference, particularly in those moments of high stress and high pressure.
So, Jamil, I've got a couple of questions just because, you know, we've kind of the conversation's more geared towards football and golf because of obviously your experiences. So the two questions I had were, what would you say the difference is between a golfer's, whether open-mindedness towards the psychology versus an individual footballer? Versus walking in front of a European Ryder Cup team as opposed to walking in front of a Premier League team. Can you kind of compare and give us a little bit of insight into both of those scenarios?
Yeah. Okay, that's a good question. Yeah, I think, yeah, personally, I think there's no difference. It's really up to the individual. You have some incredibly open-minded sports people, you know, whatever sport they're in. You know, you get some amazingly, I wouldn't say closed-minded, but you get people who don't necessarily you know, want to engage in psychology. And the worst ones for me are the ones who are somewhere in between, actually. So you get someone who sits in front of you and says, come on, then make me better. So you say, no, I can't. And psychology has to be this partnership. Like all coaching has to be a partnership. You know, you can't just impart ready-made knowledge. You have to open the door to, you know, to discovery and allow people to you know, experience at something which enables them to see things differently rather than tell them what to look for. And so when people sit in front of me with their arms folded, I've had lots of them, either in business or in sport, they sit there with their arms folded and say, come on in, give me something to make me better. you know, either say no, you know, or you sometimes give people techniques and tools, and then they'll go away and come back after a week and say, I tried that, it didn't work. Have you got anything else? And it's a bit like going to the gym, working out for an hour, going back home, looking in the mirror and saying, that's rubbish, that doesn't work. So, you know, I think it's a bit in the middle, which I don't like. I don't mind it if people don't. I mean, Ian Porter said that I never use a psychologist. I don't need a psychologist to tell me how good I am. And I'd rather someone was either against it, you know, or someone who was absolutely for it, you know, rather than these people in the middle who, I'll give it a go. And it's the giving it a go, you know, which doesn't work. And this is what we see, you know, each new year with our friends and colleagues who make these New Year's resolutions. And so I'm going to try to do this. You know, to not fully commit is definitely a route to downfall. So, you know, I don't see necessarily a difference in the sports or teams that you've mentioned. It's really in the individuals, you know, and, you know, some people are incredibly open-minded and are lifelong learners, you know, and some people, you know, believe they have the answers. You know, the one thing I will say with all the businesses that I've worked with in the last year and with some of the sports people, no, so I do believe that experimentation, open-mindedness, you know, agile thinking is key. So those who experiment the most will win, I'm convinced of it. And, so I'm often telling businesses that, you know, it's better to be disrupted from the inside than from the outside. You know, it's so much easier if the pace of change internally is matching the pace of change externally. You know, sports people are the same too. If you think about the way in which all sports have changed, either with technology, equipment, or patterns of play, you know, the way in which people play the game, they're all constantly evolving, you know, and we just need to be open-minded and agile in regard to how we challenge what we believe to be true and what's enabling us to be successful to allow us to continue to be it.
Yeah, and it's amazing whenever I speak to people who, you know, who I would consider as high performers or, you know, elite performers in their field. And when you start to try and, you know, almost unpick why they've done what they've done, it's really interesting. And it'd be good to hear your insight and your thoughts on this, is that a lot of top performers can't really explain why they're a top performer.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, 2 points on this. You know, people say that, well, they must have made so much sacrifice. And top sports performers and top business people don't even see it as sacrifice. It's a self-investment. And, you know, they're truly enjoying expressing their own talent, you know, enjoying doing what they do. So, you know, it's easy for them to practice on a rainy Friday night. You know, it's easy for them to put some hours in on a Saturday morning when their friends are still lying in bed. And it's not seen as sacrifice, it's seen as investment. You know, I'm going to invest this time in enjoying my ability. You know, and so I think that, you know, when people can't tell you what it is that's enabled them to get there, I totally understand it, because they lose themselves to something which is bigger than them. You know, and this is my point, that purpose is never achieved, it's attained on a daily basis. Sometimes the mistake that people make is they think that they've got a purpose statement. There's so many companies I know have got mission statements, but so very few on a mission. But there's no passion, there's a poster on a wall and a goal or an aim. And, you know, but when you see Tiger Woods, for example, you know, his purpose is never achieved. It's attained on a daily basis. You know, it's a reason for being, a reason to get out of bed in the morning. This is why he keeps working. But, this is why Warren Buffett keeps working, why Richard Branson keeps working. It's never achieved. It's attained on a daily basis. Tiger Woods is a bad example. He had a good reason to get out of bed in the morning. He had a good one to get back into it in the evening. Cut him from this. Here's a different example. But my point is that, you know, I totally understand it when people say that they don't really know what they do well. I just do it. I get that. And then the other thing is that, and this is almost contradictory to it, is that I often find as well that some of the best sports people have really good self-awareness. And again, I bet you've seen this in some of the teams that you've played in. That some players will have great self-awareness. They know exactly what they do right, they know exactly where their strengths are, where their weaknesses are, and some people just don't. I work with Stevie Warnock, and so ex-Liverpool and Blackburn Rovers, and his self-awareness was great. If you ever, came in, you said to him that, you know, do you have a good game? He'll say, well, I did because I did this well, but I didn't because, you know, I didn't do that particularly well. So sort of 7 out of 10. And he was incredibly accurate with it. Great self-awareness. Some players, you know, are deluded about, you know, the way in which they see the game. And so therefore have a distorted perception of their performance. And therefore, we're not gaining clarity over some of the learning which might have been offered to them if they had to see it clearer.
Today's podcast is sponsored by CSS Investments, a London-based regulated stockbroker that offers a bespoke advisory investment service for stocks and shares. I've personally used CSS for over 5 years now and happily recommend their services. You can find out more at css-investments.com. But please do remember that as with all investing, your capital is at risk. What is your take on why some people really do fulfill their potential and kind of get to the heights that they've always dreamed of, and some just maybe just fall a little bit short of maybe what they were aspiring to?
Yeah, okay. Are you asking for a friend?
Just because I only had a couple of games in the top league, I did not do more.
I think that, you know, it's an interesting one because I think two things on this. I think that, you know, you've got to be prepared to invest. So Clive Woodward talks about talent and teachability, and I totally agree. You know, we all know these kids who are great footballers at 13, 14, you know, great rugby players at 12, you know, amazing cricketer, you know, at 16, who go on and don't fulfill their potential. But I feel that one of the reasons why is that they're not prepared to self-invest. And, so talent is not enough. You know, it's about teachability. So, you know, our ability to translate circumstance and situation into learning. So failure is part payment towards success. The price of success is always paid in full and in advance. At home, you can't be number one in the world and then start making mistakes or learning the game. It doesn't work like that. The price of success is always paid in full and in advance. And I think some people really know this. Some people know that I have to invest. I have to put some serious time and commitment into playing and performing and learning. And I'm going to have to deal with failure. I have to deal with setback. And I have to deal with things not working out as well as I want them to. So if you can see success and failure as outcomes, not attitudes, if you can see them as equal opportunities to learn and understand that you will experience both, if you can put proper time into your talent in developing it, understanding it, and experiencing it, I think that people can give themselves a really good opportunity, you know, to perform at their highest levels. So, you know, I think they're probably things that I'll call out. I'm sure there's lots more, but there's probably two things I'll call out, which is dealing with failure, rejection, and things not working out, and making sure that you invest in your talent and teach yourself, you know, and learn better, you know, on how to maximise it.
And that's brilliant, Jamil, but sort of slightly Kipling-esque, I would say. I don't know whether you've been reading If a little bit there, but it does make me think that. Is it just down to, can you not just, if you have a good result, stay on a level footing or a level ground? And if you don't have a good result, you stay on a level ground because they have the same intrinsic meaning, I'm guessing. So why doesn't everybody do that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the psychology behind that is loss aversion as much as anything else. We don't like to lose. You know, it's that simple. So, you know, because we don't like to lose, we don't frame it properly. So framing it properly, you know, is probably the way forwards. Okay? You know, there's a company who I did some work with who don't say failure. They say learning moments. There's another company I work with who, you know, ask a question regularly, which is, you know, what failures are you celebrating at the moment? What's been your favourite failure this month? So I think that, you know, we almost need to see this differently. And if we can reframe it and gain a new perspective on it, then maybe it won't have the emotional connection that it does. So we're born necessarily imperfect. You know, we come into this world not knowing everything. And we go out in the world not knowing everything. So, you know, what's our purpose? Our purpose is to develop, learn, and grow. How do you develop, learn, and grow if you're not prepared to fail? can't happen. But if you look at babies, toddlers, it's estimated that we learn the most between the ages of 1 and 3. Between the one and three is when we learn the most in our entire lifetime. That's quite depressing, isn't it? The reason why is that if you look at a one-year-old, two-year-old, three-year-old, all they're doing is playing. It's the only thing they do is play. And, so they learn how to walk, talk, eat with a spoon. They learn how to hold a pen. They learn how to do everything between 1 and 3. And they do it by repeatedly failing at it. So everything that you and I know how to do now, you know, walk, talk, write with a pen, eat with a knife and fork, we've learned by repeatedly failing at it. So, you know, as a baby will learn to walk by spending a year and a half, all day, every day for a year and a half, trying to walk. This is why you see these babies doing little sit-ups. And that sit-up is trying to get into a biped position to walk. So, you know, the baby spends a year and a half, all day, every day, trying to walk. Eventually gets up, wobbles about, and then falls over and laughs about it. Can you imagine if we were 30 or 40 and learned how to walk? What would happen is that we would get up to walk for the first time in our entire lives, age 30, and we'd fall down. All our friends would laugh at us, and we would feel embarrassed. And someone would say, you know, why don't you read a book? I have a great book about it, and I'll teach you how to do it. You read the book, you get up to walk, you fall down. And then someone says, I'll teach you. I can run, so walking's easy, I'll teach you. Biomechanically, they're not the same as you, not a great teacher, you get the walk, you fall down. And what do you do then? You then start to justify why crawling is where it's at. And then you guys are wasting your time walking. I can crawl to the car, get where I want to. There's no point in walking. It's almost easier to justify our bad habits, you know, than it is to invest in making ourselves better. You know, so, you know, this is where babies have the advantage, you know, is that they don't see winning and losing, failing and succeeding. They see play. And whenever I used to work with golfers, you know, if I meet someone coming out of the clubhouse or something at lunchtime, I say, oh, where are you going now? And so I'm going to the range to do some work. You know, no one ever said, I'm going to go to the range and do some play. No, I'm going to go to the range to do some work. You know, work is about endeavor. It's about toil. You know, it's about running through treacle. But, you know, it's hard. Yeah, so maybe some of the reframing and choosing different words and different thinking may allow us to choose a different feeling, different doing.
Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant, because I've come across a similar version or a similar definition of failure that really helped me. And I must have heard it nearly 20 years ago now. And it was to do with, there's no such thing as failure, only feedback. And whenever you're talking about, you know, the failure, there's not failure in that company you mentioned. There's only learning moments. Really, it's just that reframing. It's almost like the self-talk, the psycholinguistics that we use. It really defines what our reality is.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we live in a world of our own making. You know, it's that simple. So the world reflects back. You know, tends to treat us like we treat it. You know, this is why, you know, you hear players say, I never perform, you know, well when this guy's refereeing, never perform well, you know, when I play golf in Ireland, never perform well. And you hear business people, we can't sell in that geography. People don't buy that length of contract there. But these guys are always hard to work with. Whenever we pitch against these guys, we always lose. And we live in this world of our own making. It reflects back. I pretty much guarantee you, mate, that the hardest thing that I do in business or in sport is trying to convince people that the world that they're experiencing is merely a reflection of their own attitude towards it. Guarantee it's the hardest thing to do. I'm convincing them of it. You know, and try and break that belief system, you know, get them to create a new perspective, which allows them new possibilities and new opportunities.
And is that only language, or is that more maybe showing them a different way or a different option that maybe they've never come across?
Yeah, I think maybe all those things. You know, I think that you always need to be careful of robbing people of the experience of discovery. You know, you don't really want to give answers, and I often can't. You know, I'm not a banker. You know, I'm not a golfer. All the people I work with, I don't know their stuff. You know, so it's probably more about asking the right questions, you know, than it is, you know, trying to give people the right answers. And I honestly believe that people know the answers anyway. I think if you said to anyone, what is it that makes you better? What will make you better? I think we'd all know. You know, the difference is that You know, we don't necessarily do it. We don't execute upon it. And we don't really execute upon what will make us better because we don't necessarily see our world as changeable. It's something that, yeah, I'd like to do, but, you know, this always gets out in the way, or, yeah, I'd like to commit to that, but it's tricky for me because, you know, so I think that I wouldn't say we self-sabotage, because we don't. That's a psychological principle. It's probably a bit lengthy for now, but I wouldn't say we self-sabotage, but we... it's almost easier to justify our own bad habits than it is to commit to good ones. So some people will say that we are pleasure-seeking animals as human beings. I'm not sure how true that is. I think that we're pain-avoiding animals. You know, this is why, you know, everyone knows that going for a run is good for them, and people don't do it because they don't like the fact they're going to be bent double, unable to breathe. So, you know, it's... We all know that broccoli, yeah, will keep you alive longer. No, it's a superfood, but none of us have it raw for breakfast in the morning. So I guess as human beings, we're experts at knowing one thing and doing another.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because I sometimes fall in and out of those kind of mindsets, if that's the way you want to call it. And it probably was more after the plan days, you know, when you do know what you should be doing, but you don't always do what you know. But I think that's definitely a conversation for another time, possibly over a beer or two. But Jamal, I wanted to just touch on lightly, because is it true that you were able to study NASA, the space program, and be around astronauts? Is that true, what I was researching?
Yes. Yeah, in 2008. In 2008, I was fortunate enough to work with NASA astronauts, people on NASA, the space program. But my role was quite limited, actually. I was looking at recovery. And the interesting thing is that people who perform at the highest levels, so be that astronauts, be it medical teams, fighter pilots, premiership footballers, people who perform at the highest levels all have really good recovery. They build in lots of recovery time. So recovery is an essential part of high performance. You know, as business people, we, you know, where's your ice bath? You know, we tend not to do it, do we? Kind of pack our diary, grab a sandwich on the go, but start early because we need to get stuff done. And then in the evening, we'll still be doing some emails. And it's one of the differentiators I see between high-performing sports people and high-performing business people. Lots of business people work really long hours, pedal fast. You know, lots of sports people who perform at a high level will take lots of time out. You know, and that recovery and recuperation is really important from a mental and physical perspective. So my work, you know, was to do with recovery. And I, you know, now advocate, you know, particularly with the times that we're in at the moment, an advocate for, you know, lots of business people to make sure that, you know, you're fitting in your recovery, because it's an essential part of high performance. It's almost counterintuitive that, you know, we need to take more time out to get more done. You know, and the more that we can create some time and space, you know, maybe the more productive and useful, beneficial we can be to the outcomes and objectives that we're committing to.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Jamal, you're just touching on maybe how recovery in the corporate world is equally as important as it was in the sports world, and I absolutely agree. Whenever I was playing, you know, we were only training really a couple of hours a day because it's really difficult to do more than 2-3 hours of physical training. And the rest was simply coming back, resting, eating the food, rehydrating, etc. How does that apply? And not just the recovery element of it, but how do you apply the lessons from sport that you've learned with these top golfers, these top footballers? How do you then apply them and translate them across into the corporate world?
Yeah, well, I think that storytelling is quite useful. So trying to get people to understand and, again, change your perspective, change your mindset on things. So most of my work in businesses is based upon cultural change or leadership development or engagement. So I always think for people to act differently, they need to think differently. create some different behaviors or outcomes. It's really about creating some different thinking, some different thoughts. So what I try to do is to help people change the words and pictures in their heads to drive different feelings and therefore different actions. So storytelling can be quite a useful way, you know, to get people to move away from targets, metrics, objectives, into a space of understanding themselves better in the context of what they're trying to achieve. And also getting people to sort of co-author and co-create some better ways of working or different ways of doing can be useful. So getting people together and allowing them to share collective experience and knowledge, you know, create some new perspectives from each other. So it's very hard sometimes for, you know, independents or contractors or consultants to go in and say, this is what you should be doing, you know, be really prescriptive. And, you know, these people are often experts in their area, you know, whether they work in a bank or whether they work in a football team. You know, it's much more about, as I mentioned previously, asking the right questions to allow people to uncover, unravel and different ways of working for themselves. So, and they can often do that together. And you know, I think that one of the things which is missing is this time and space. You know, lots of people will have meetings that finish at 10 o'clock. When does their next meeting start? 10 o'clock. And their job, you know, as talented business people in those two meetings, their job is to get through them, get through them. How many times, you know, do we end up sitting in back-to-back meetings? We get these two out of the way, I can get on with some work. It's quite incredible how we don't necessarily understand the difference between productivity and activity. So, you know, I think that, you know, once we create some time and space for people, get them to talk and engage, get them to discuss, ask some good questions, get them to think outside of the mental tram lines that we all occupy, this habitual thinking, then we start to think in a more divergent manner. We start to make the connection between two things that we didn't connect before, which leads us ultimately to more successful outcomes.
And I suppose one of the things that really comes to mind as you were talking through all the different areas that you would work on, whether it's in a with an individual, whether it's CEO or MD, that, you know, a team within the organization, the big thing for me is really around accountability and maybe how you help people maybe take more. Because again, without, you know, I'm absolutely in no position to be judging people, but this is more of an observation that within sport, and especially, you know, the sort of the best players I came across, accountability was everything. You know, if something didn't go the way they planned it, it was always down to them. They weren't blaming other people. But that isn't always the case in the corporate world. And I feel that there's more blame, more of a blame culture, more people who are kind of not always taking 100% accountability for what they're doing. How do you manage to try and help them further along that spectrum?
Yeah, the way in which you help people is to call it out. You know, I think that, you know, we need to explicitly call out ownership, accountability, responsibility, you know, as key cultural assets. So if you think about it, you know, no one has ever wandered around the bottom of a mountain and then simply found themselves at the top. You know, it takes dedication, resilience, commitment, you know, all of those things. And so, you know, let's start to call out some of those cultural assets and attributes in regard to character, you know, which is needed to be successful. Lots of people focus on process. Later people focus on operations, on procedure. This is how we, what we need to do, much more so than how we need to be. And I think that better conversations around some of these cultural aspects and characteristics are probably what's needed. I always say, you know, the tailor's adage, you know, tailors who make clothes, they'll always say, measure twice, cut once. We put these teams together, tell them what we're looking to achieve and do, and go away and do it. Rather than spending some time thinking about the dynamic and culture that we want to create in the team to allow us to go and do it. And we need to call out ownership as an important part of that. So I always say that blame looks backwards and responsibility looks forwards. And that's a universal law. You know, blame looks backwards, responsibility looks forwards. And blame anyone and everyone for non-performance. We can do it in sport, we do it in business all the time. But you're right, the people who perform at optimum levels, people who perform best, take full responsibility. And, you know, they'll become very self-aware, good personal introspection. You know, they realise what their contribution should be and know whether they have done it or not. I think one of the complexities with business, and if we're being fair, as opposed to sport, is that, you know, the reason why a Premiership football team can play really well together for 90 minutes, unless they're West Bromwich Albion, is because they all have a clarity on winning. So you've got these players, you've got these 11 players, and six or seven of them might not even speak the same language. Don't speak the same language, different religions, different cultures, different backgrounds, different educations, different times in their career. But they play brilliantly together for 90 minutes. And the reason why they do that is because everyone has clarity on what winning looks like. Everyone knows how to win a game of football. And everyone knows their role and position and contribution. That's what we should be doing. Let's take that back to business. I think sometimes in business, the metrics are complex. Don't know whether we're winning or not. We seem to be winning in this area, but we're not in that one. And you know, there's a real complexity to some of the metrics and some of the targets and objectives. And then you've got the individual lines of business, directorates and teams and geographies who have their own set of metrics, which supposedly contribute, but they may be measured and recognised upon a variety of things which may not necessarily agree with that end purpose. And people may have different viewpoints on what their role and responsibility is, not necessarily having the clarity. So you can see how the simplicity of football, for example, and a team and how to win it, enables people to be more responsible. But you can also see in business how it's a little bit more complex when there's different moving parts, measured, recognised and rewarded in different ways.
Listen, there's just so many points in that within that just sort of jump out at me. And I think the last one that you mentioned was the clarity. I think that's the real big one for me, that I kind of come across a lot of people who, you know, I think we're naturally really hardworking people and, you know, in this part of the world. And people do really put in a shift, but I just don't always think they have the clarity of A, what they're doing in terms of their own personal life and what they're trying to achieve. And I suppose that's why the first question that I ask is, what is the definition of success? But then, of course, once you go into an organizational perspective, you're then thinking everybody's kind of working on different things. And is there real clarity that all comes together? And when you talked about the football, you know, that really comes back to it's teamwork, isn't it? Ultimately, it's working as a team to achieve an end goal. What I've always found, and this is why this whole field of psychology always fascinates me, that even within that team, it really only takes one individual not to perform and suddenly the team can perform.
Yes, yeah, 100%. That's absolutely right. And, you know, sometimes, you know, to complicate that, they might be doing five or six things very well, but one very badly. So, you know, they end up winning a game every now and then for you, which is great. But how much do they contribute to what's not happening in your team? You know, without naming names, you know, I've seen it in cricket and I've seen it in football before, you know, where you get a star performer who can score some goals or, you know, do something very well. But because they're lacking in teamship, their destructive contribution can be such that they can score goals, but you can still lose. So, you know, there's a balance to be had, you know, between weighing up what makes a good team player. And you get this individual excellence, which is needed, but you've also got the ability to be a winner who creates other winners. And I'm someone who can bring other people along and can gain a level of motivation and a level of engagement with other team members to enable them to optimize their own talent. So there is a complexity to it, isn't there? When you look at sort of, you know, all teams, be it in business or sport, you know, I remember a football manager saying to me that, you know, how do you manage a team of millionaires? You know, all these people who, you know, have their own goals, their own ambitions, their own ego, you know. But let's go back to my original statement about this, about clarity, about knowing contribution. You know, when you would have been in the dressing room, you would have had a presentation to the team, which would have told you what winning looks like. This is how we're going to beat these guys. And, then someone may have come around with a, you know, chalkboard, you know, and showed you personally, this is what we need from you. Here's going to be your contribution today. And, you know, you'll analyse the people you're playing against. You'll know the competition. You'll know their pattern of play or way of being. You'll know their results. Yeah, so I guess that, you know, that's our conversation comes full circle. You know, let's have a look at what we can learn from business and sport. You know, and some of those points there in itself, you know, are incredibly useful in the business environment too.
Brilliant, Jamel. This has been so interesting and really fascinating for me, because I've obviously been a big fan of yours and the work that you've done across not just football and obviously my sport, but across golf and cricket and other ones as well. So listen, I'm not going to keep it for too much longer, but I just have two last questions for you. What would you say is the price of success, and whether that's for yourself, because obviously you've been incredibly successful in your career, or maybe what you have seen people paying a price for success, of course, if there is one?
Yeah, so the price of success for me, I would say, is to be able to reinvent and repurpose. People don't like it. You know, we don't like change, and there's lots of psychology into that, which we haven't got time for. But to be able to reimagine, repurpose, reinvent is incredibly important. But that's part of the price of success. It's almost easier to stay within our comfort zone, continue to do what's enabled us to be successful. But if you want to continue success, you almost need to give up what's allowing you to be successful now. Because the world is changing, and that's for everyone. So because of that, you know, we need to be more open-minded and more agile in our thinking, and be able to think, if it ain't broke, I'm going to break it. I'm going to try something different. And that can be a price of success. You know, the other price of success for people, which is incredibly important in sport and business, is to experiment, knowing that we may not have certain outcomes. So our ability to deal with this failure and to try some stuff and it not work is an incredible asset. You know, I'll often say to people, I'll tell you how to be successful, you know, double your rate of failure. You know, if we can do that, you know, it means that, you know, we're continually adjusting. And that continual adjustment and experimentation, you know, is key to testing our own talent, but also challenging some of the assumptions that our thinking is based upon.
Brilliant, fantastic answer. And so that just leads me into my last question, because at the start I asked you, what is the definition of success? And I think you said it's always paid in full and in advance for the price of success. But what would you say for you as a guy today, going forward in your life, what is your definition of success?
My definition of success is probably more than 7 hours sleep. So if I can get that, I'll be on the moon. So for some reason at the moment, I'm working all sorts of hours. So, you know, I'm talking a lot about work-life balance to teams. And because they're in Dubai, I'm talking about work-life balance at 4:30 in the morning. So, you know, it's the irony of it. So I think that it's more about doctor, heal thyself. And it's amazing because, you know, cobbler's children have the worst worn shoes, don't they? And then people like you and I, you know, always advising people on what to do, and then we go back and do the opposite. But, you know, hopefully we won't be rumbled, and we can change our bad ways sooner rather than later.
Brilliant, Jamel. Very, very honest of you. And listen, thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully everyone who's listening to that and watched that today has absolutely loved it, and there's so many great nuggets of information and wisdom in there. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Paul. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you.
I'm going to be here on Monday, the 26th of April, with Shaka Hislop, who's a former Premier League player and an ESPN analyst. So please come and join us for that. And thanks for listening. Well, if you didn't take anything from that episode, then I don't know what we can do, because there were so many amazing pieces of information, helpful points, things that you can implement and apply to your life straight away just from listening to Jamel Qureshi. Incredible as a performance psychologist with golfers, with Premier League footballers and in the cricket world, as well as studying the NASA space program. There's just so much information and knowledge that he had that he was so kind of him to share with us. So I hope you love that, and please join us again for another episode of The Psychology of Success. And a final thank you to Moment Digital, who have produced today's live show, and that's Neil Stainsby and Peter Wright. Haley Brasnett is the editor for all of the episodes that go up on iTunes and Spotify. Dave Webster has been our researcher, and Emily Drake does all of our social media marketing so we can get out every single episode of The Psychology of Success.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.